number 12350, Flying Officer S.A. Anderson, Reel 3.
Flying Officer Anderson, Reel 3.
My office was informed that crankcases on a certain aircraft, a Tomahawk, that was coming out to operate in the desert from America, was the crankcases on the engines were showing an astonishingly high percentage of cracks. And of course, this is where my commercial flying training came in. I'd been trained as a commercial mechanic, and I examined a number of these cases and found that somebody had taken a 10-pound maul and put a piece of chamois leather over it and given a just beautifully graduated bang on the mounting of an oil pipe which was going to the cooler from the engine. And it didn't show at all, not when you were looking at a clean crankcase. But if you ran that engine for a few hours, the vibration and normal, I suppose, elasticity of the metal from which the crankcase was made made the crack grow, and then in the heat of the desert and all flying in that area, you would lose a lot of oil, and that didn't do the engine any good. And they wanted to know where this was occurring. Well, it was just a matter of having found out what the damage was, how it was done. That was out of my hands then. What happened, I don't know. You never had even heard of it. You know, what went on.
Who would investigate that, then?
Well, wherever the things came from. They came from America. And then there was the business of the genius who sent all the petrol that was used by the troops in all sections of the services in the desert. They'd send them up in 10-gallon cans that you could put a pencil through. You could have taken a pencil in your hand and pushed it through. And of course, anybody who wanted to sabotage, all they had to do was that. A 3-inch motion of the wrist and a pencil in the hand, and all the juice would be flowing out, evaporating, of course, in the heat, no time at all.
Was it not more likely that things like the crankcases had been interfered with since they'd arrived?
No. Not really. Whoever did it knew exactly what they were doing and just exactly how to do it. The type of injury to the crankcase is absolutely consistent. It was a skilled job. But I think it was probably done in America. They had their spies and saboteurs over there, so, same as we did in Germany. Things like that, you know. It was called on to investigate. Sometimes it involved going out to an outlying station and spending the night there, and in order to save time and trouble, you find out what is the you get the commanding officer to tell you what the trouble was alleged to be, and it would probably be stealing or something or another. And that meant that you had to get up in the night about three times and then go out to where the thefts were occurring. And then you could pinpoint it, and with any luck, you could give the commanding officer an idea of where he should post lookouts according to what was being taken, really. I don't remember what they were. There was something. It's so long ago, you know.
Did you ever feel frustrated that you couldn't follow through?
Not really, yourself? Because there was always something to do. We had cases of officers going mad when they saw the sound. And we had one fellow done brilliantly in the Battle of Britain, got married, wife had a baby. Then they sort of posted him out to Egypt. He took one look at the sand and went completely bonkers.
What did he do?
Took his uniform off and started drinking. And again, General Dog's body office boy, me, told to go and see if I could find the fellow. I found him and put in a report saying, well, I was no psychiatrist, I thought it would be a good idea if he was examined by one. I wanted to spare him a court-martial, because there was no question of his gallantry or anything like that. He's a noble fellow and a skilled pilot. He just slipped a peg when he saw the sign. It happened.
Do you remember who he was?
People know. I wouldn't anyway. I wouldn't give a name in a case like that anyway. And then we had other things. We had, well, thank God, very few of them, and a few rotten eggs that were given money by their squadron mates who were out in the desert to buy various things to bring back. And then they claimed that they were robbed. I had a couple of cases of that. And that's a method of interrogation, you know. You can always get a fellow to trip himself up if you make him repeat the story over and over. You'll find there are discrepancies in time and place. And you ask the same question in a different way several times. And then you make no sign that you've seen anything odd about it. But when you think the moment is psychologically apt, you spring it on the man, you say, well, you said so and so. And either there's an indignant denial or a horrified silence, or is that really so? They betray themselves. A guilty conscience is a terrible thing.
Had you had any particular training in interrogation?
No. Except, of course, when I was training as a policeman in the ranks. No, I must say, really, I was very lucky in the war. I was bombed and machine gunned a few times, but all things considered, I think I was very lucky.
So this is into 1942 now?
Yeah, and I was, April 42, I was doing this plainclothes police work, and one day I had a terrible headache in the morning. I could hardly see. I called up my flight sergeant, McKenzie, and told him I was inoperative for that day at least. And would he get hold of a doctor from the 15th Scottish, which was a town near outside Cairo, 15th Scottish Hospital, and send somebody to examine me and find out what was wrong. And a doctor turned up. I was living in Diggs. 36 Malika Farida in Cairo, and he turned up there with an ambulance and they examined me and he said, now you're coming with me, my boy. And they took me out to the 15th Scottish and took a spinal tap, discovered I was crawling with meningitis. And then they gave me MNB-693, which was the main break of the new thing then. They gave me, first of all, with a needle, and then when I couldn't take it anymore, they gave me orally. And I found that I was quite helpless. I was in bed, I couldn't lift my arms or do anything. And I was in hospital there for about a couple of, well, I suppose about 5 weeks. And they sent me down to Port Tufik and to the hospital ship Atlantis. And we went from there to Durban, where I was put on a train and taken to Pietermaritzburg, where the Oribe Military Hospital is. and I was there for about 6 weeks, and they put me aboard the hospital ship Atlantis, which had been a cruiser in the First World War. It was a nice ship. And back to England we went, and I was at Wingfield Morris Hospital, which was being run by Gaythorne Girdleston, who was a very well-known orthopedic surgeon, and was actually the man who introduced my father to my mother, by a curious coincidence. From then on, it was a matter of getting back on my feet, being a bleeding out, of course. Then my daughter was born, almost to the day, 9 months after my first leave out of the hospital. And then a man I've been unable to trace since, because he didn't serve very long in the Air Force, not long enough to get a pension. Osmond Clark, his name was, and he was the chief orthopedist. It's OSMINDECLARK. And he was the chief orthopedist in 1943. And he's an air commodore, so he wasn't a nobody.
Yes.
And he ordered me out of England because the climate was so bad for my condition. And my wife and I, and my daughter, got aboard the Umgeni. It was one of the three 10,000-tonner nice little motor ships that ran between Liverpool and... No, not Liverpool. Between Glasgow and Rhodesia in South Africa, that way. And they had three, the Umtali, the Umtata, and the Umgeni. They were all motor ships, and they were all fairly modern. And all the cabins were all for three, which was rather unfortunate for the poor married people who had been a part of the war and were now being repatriated, the Rhodesians and South Africans and people. And they're all being repatriated. And really, there's quite a queue for the lifeboats, because, of course, they have covers. And anybody, I don't know if you've done any sea travelling.
A bit.
Well, you know about lifeboats. Anyway, the poor devils, I mean, it was perfectly natural for them to want to get together, for heaven's sake. But I was lucky because I had my daughter, you see. So my wife and I and the kid were in one cabin together. And when I was in South Africa, I was chairman of the second South African branch of the Royal Air Forces Association. Our president was Bomber Harris, and the vice president was a South African doctor, a wonderful fellow, Hoffman. And we put ourselves on the map by having a big ball at the City Hall. I happen to have a friend, Tyrone Power. He's a film star, you heard?
Yes.
Well, he was on a round the world goodwill trip in an old DC-3. And I knew his publicity man, Gallagher, too. And I asked, there was a strict sort of iron curtain, you might say, around them. They didn't want to be disturbed or have anybody talk to them. But I got through to Gallagher and asked him, would he get Ty to come on to the RAF Association ball and as our guest? Because everybody heard that Ty was going to be there. We sold the tickets like hotcakes, and it was a terrific social success. We had Harris there too, you see. I must find that attaché case of mine with the pictures and things in it. Mm-hmm. Because I've got all the documentation and photographs and signed things. Unfortunately, I mislaid it. I thought it was in that cupboard there. I have to have somebody take everything out of there and have a look.
Can I just go back to September 40 when you were first commissioned? This was in the middle of the Battle of Britain. Were you keen to fly at that time?
Oh, yes. The Battle of Britain? I didn't need to do anything but help. That's why I joined up in the first place. I just thought they'd make use of my already learned skills. They said, oh, now everything you learned on is obsolete. And of course, it was being civilian aircraft, quite different from the service types. They would have had to take me and put me through the whole thing again.
There was no question of being able to do that.
No, they didn't do it with anybody. The only people who went straight from Civvy Street to fly aircraft for the services were the air transport auxiliary people who were, in any case, flying near prototypes of the things that were being used to fight with. One automatically assumes, you know, pilot, war, aircraft, but no, it's nothing like that.
But you were at these Battle of Britain bases.
I was beginning to feel them. And wait a minute, what? Again, I say that so glibly. Was it Biggin Hill or was it near Ipswich, another place? Anyway, it's where Douglas Bader's squadron was, and I was briefly with him.
What were you doing at the... What did you do at...
The debriefing thing. Because, again, it helped having done a bit of flying.
Yes. What was your impression of the pilots?
Oh, they were terrific. I'm proud to have been born on the same planet. They were wonderful. All of them, the Czechs, the Poles, the French Canadians, British, name it. They were wonderful. I can't remember having met any of them that I didn't think was real prince. I remember I told you about our Austrian count, Manfred von Tschernin. He died about 10 years ago as a stockbroker in Johannesburg. Seems such a prosaic end for a man who had done so much. And of course, Bader was a marvellous fellow with the disabled. He went around lecturing and showing what could be done with prostheses. As did another fellow I was in hospital with in Oxford, a New Zealander, Taylor his name was. He had a company, Meadows and Taylor, in Auckland. What they did, I don't know. But he was an enormous man, 6'4", and a sort of 50-inch chest unexpanded. And we called him Dumbo, of course, flying elephant. He had a terrible time because he was flying Wellingtons and on coming in after a raid, the tail wheel touched the boundary fence. No damage was done, but they felt it, and so, because he was the captain of the aircraft, he had to get out and have a look. Would you excuse me?